Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, IndyCar fans. This is Nathan Brown, your Motorsports Insider with the Indianapolis Star. I am back in Indianapolis after a long, wild weekend in St. Petersburg, still down in the caffeine as I was all weekend long trying to stay awake and keep up with everything. It was a wild weekend. It was an awesome weekend. It was great to be back at a racetrack. And we are here on IndyCar Weekly to dive into everything that went on track, off track at St. Pete. Of course, with me is my guest host, Stefan Wilson, who took in everything from home, watched the race on Sunday, and we have lots of thoughts on what took place. Excited to dive into all of this and excited to give a little sneak peek at what will be going on in 2 weekends at the Thermal Club in Southern California for IndyCar's $1 Million Challenge, their version of a non-points all-star type event. Before we get into that, Stefan, thanks for joining me again this week. I'll let you take it away. What were some of your first thoughts on this season opening IndyCar race in 2024?
My main thought that coming away from the weekend was fair play to Felix Rosenquist. I was kind of unsure on how he was going to do in this new environment at Meyer Shank Racing, coming from Arrow McLaren, this powerhouse. Not that Meyer Shank and Andretti Global is not a powerhouse too, but I felt like maybe we'd seen the best that Felix could offer, and he just blew it out the water the whole weekend. So strong. Now the race, he fell back a little bit, ended up seventh, but I mean, fair play. The entire weekend, just, you know, he looked like a force to be reckoned with, and I was a little bit shocked by that, and I got to give him some kudos. So that was the first takeaway. How did it look on your end being there in person?
On Felix and on MSR, I spoke with some folks after the race on their team, and it was like, I think in some respects, maybe in a different year, say this was a group, say this was year one. Let's go back to 2022 when Simon Pagenaud was joining the team, or maybe even last year. St. Pete was obviously a terrible weekend for them, but say this was Simon, who is this championship winning veteran who comes to the team, puts the car on the front row, and if you come away from that weekend and you finish seventh, I'm not sure how a driver maybe like Simon or this team would view that. Maybe you see it as a little bit of a missed opportunity. I kind of thought a little bit like that even when Jack Harvey was in the car. They were either on the front row or maybe on the second row a couple years ago, maybe in 2021. And I remember talking to Jack and getting a little bit of a sense that maybe they felt like that was an opportunity where they could have gotten that first win for the team. Obviously, a couple months later, Elio goes and wins the 500. But I feel like for a team that completely reset its driver lineup, who is obviously continuing to work with Andretti, a team that had some changes this offseason, I think for Felix to come out and have a straightaway, I think he paced the first practice.
Half a second.
Yeah, yeah.
That's unheard of.
In this series, I think the first eight rows of the field on Sunday in qualifying were 6/10 of a second. So that puts some perspective in there for you. So for Felix to just have a clean weekend, he's talked a lot about racecraft being the thing that he's working on right now as a driver. A lot of the 3 years that he spent with Arrow McLaren were good qualifying weekends where he makes a small mistake and crashes the car. I think to a handful of races, especially these last 2 years where that seemed like it was the case. And so for him to just keep it clean, We'll get into this a little bit later. I think there was definitely a discrepancy between Honda and Chevy this weekend. So yeah. seventh sounds like maybe he's not as good as it was. That means he was
Honda.
Yeah, third or fourth Honda. I think that's really solid. And I think even for Tom Blomqvist, who I think finished in the top 20 in his fourth race in IndyCar with a new team, to keep it clean, to just come out of here with not with a bunch of headaches that you got to fix. I think they proved that they made some strides this off season in what was one of the biggest, if not the biggest, changes for a team this off season. So that was awesome to see.
Yeah, no. And then obviously the other big takeaway was the Penske domination that we saw. You know, Joseph pretty much dominated the entire weekend, you know, getting the pole, leading 92 laps, I believe it was.
Correct.
And then, you know, his teammates who didn't have as clean a qualifying sessions started a little further back. You know, the cream rises to the top. You know, they were third and fourth. So that, you know, three Penske's in the top four. If you're that group, you're feeling pretty happy with where things started.
Definitely. It's Saturday and Sunday is Penske related, and how much of it is Chevy related? Obviously, mm-hmm. Chevy swept the top four this weekend, Pato Award finishing second. Joseph, as we said, winning this weekend really comfortably. I think he finished with like a 7.9 second cushion on Pato, and that was, you know, after a restart within the final, it was like 30-ish laps or so. So that wasn't even like that was, you know, built over the entire race. I think I was going through some statistics from last year, and the way in which Team Penske ran so solid on ovals and then didn't have typically a whole lot on road or street courses. I mean, I know Scott McLaughlin challenged for a win at Nashville. He did really struggle on those road and street courses. And so seeing that from him, was really great. Last year, just in general, was a Honda dominated year. You had Pulo win five races, Scott Dixon I think win four, so right there at Ganassi you got nine wins, and then Kirkwood won two, so that's 11 of your 17 races. Interesting to see what that split becomes this year. I think it was even more so, even a bigger split on poles on Honda versus Chevy last year, so we'll see how that splits. Last year Honda I think swept the top four of two races. If I remember right, I think that was Toronto and Long Beach. So not something we see often. So to see Chevy right out of the gate performing like that, they drivers talked post-race about how Chevy like sent a decent contingent of people to the United Kingdom to meet with McLaren at its MTC in the UK with Pato and Alexander Rossi to go over some things they wanted to see with some of McLaren's best engineers. They had a similar meeting at Team Penske headquarters with folks there. So I don't know exactly how unique those types of meetings are, but you know, maybe that's a somewhat similar cadence that you would have over an off season. But to do something like that, especially when this specific engine formula, without the hybrid, we're only going to see it for maybe eight races or so. The level of energy it seems like they may have put into just trying to find and extract one tiny bit for these couple races before we get the hybrid introduced somewhere around July is interesting to see. And it will be interesting to see just how much that can be over the course of that whole stretch of the year.
Yeah, well, some of those meetings could have been taking place just because of the hybrid system
also
coming in. Mm-hmm. So, but at the same time, you know, it seems like Chevy's reaping the rewards of those meetings. I mean, anytime you can have FaceTime with engineers at McLaren, MTC, and at Team Penske headquarters, there's just, you know, those kind of conversations are not only going to help and develop, and it might give an opportunity for a Pato or a Rossi to be like, hey, and also can you fix this, or can you make this slightly better? And,
exactly.
You know, four out of the top five Chevys, six out of the top 10. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's considering you've got five Ganassi cars and, you know, essentially, you know, five Andretti MSR cars. That's pretty good to have those kind of, that kind of ratio for Chevy. And let's go right into Ganassi. You know, that was not the kind of weekend that you expect from the reigning champions. And we kind of touched on this last week leading into St. Pete. How was expanding the five cars potentially going to impact their program? I kind of thought they were going to handle this better, but it seems like it just kind of, the whole weekend just wasn't shiny. You know, Palou still managed to, you know, drag that car back into the top six. Dixon, you know, finishing ninth. But it's not kind of what we expect from Ganassi. So they've got to be, there's got to be some conversations going on this week, I imagine, in amongst that camp of, okay, how do we iron out some of the kinks in this new enlarged group?
I know I remember from last year, Palou kind of had a similar whole lot in qualifying. If I remember right, it was one of maybe the two races of the year that he finished eighth, and that was his worst weekend of the year. And I felt like we had a lot of that. This had a lot of similar characteristics. He qualified 13th. That was a big deal on Saturday outside of Joseph's pole and Felix being so incredibly close. I'm trying to remember what the stat was. I think they were separated by 58 thousandths of a second. It was the closest road and street course qualifying deficit between one and two in like 12 years or something like that. It was amazing. But so Alex qualifies 13th. You wonder, you know, is that the type of position where you could find yourself in some lap one carnage? A lot of, you know, similar, you know, guys who qualified in a similar position last year, the race is over in three turns. We obviously didn't see nearly that type of a start this year. And Alex very quietly climbs his way to sixth place. I think that's one thing that I was impressed by is, you know, if that's a bad weekend for them this year, then this field is going to be in real trouble. Now we'll find out later in the year as we go on, maybe through the end of May or June, if they have the same level of firepower when they are just hitting on all cylinders on their good weekends. But if this is a bad weekend for Alex Palou, then that's going to be tough for Team Penske, for Aaron McLaren, for Andretti, etc. Now, the rest of the field, you know, Scott Dixon was similarly kind of invisible. I think he qualified maybe a couple spots better than Alex, and he finishes, I mean, I've got it pulled up here, what he finishes ninth. Yeah. You know, Alex or Dixon last year, kind of invisible, but still, I think finishes on the podium, finishes third. Very different weekend for him in that respect. This continues to be one of the very few races on the IndyCar calendar that Scott Dixon has not won. This was the 20th anniversary this year. And then after you get past those guys, you go down to Kiffin Simpson in 14th, which I think was really good for him and the number four crew. There's a lot of new folks on that car that had previously been working in other series. Chip Ganassi told us that as they expanded this crew to this group to five cars in IndyCar this year, a lot of what they did was pull over people from their Extreme E program that had also been running out of Indianapolis. They are not participating in that series this year. And so while that is not a group that is entirely all of those people, they kind of try to scatter them across their four existing. I was impressed. I think I don't know remember exactly where he qualified. I think it was in that somewhere in that 15 to 20 range. And so for
23rd, I think.
Yeah, so maybe it was even worse than that.
Yeah.
So for him to climb, for him to you know stay out of trouble, as we saw with some of his teammates now, Marcus Armstrong, you know, made a mistake himself going into turn 10, going wide, hitting the barriers, his race was over. Linus Sundqvist, that didn't have as much of an issue. I mean, he got hit from behind.
Good hit, yeah.
So, but it's still a weekend, you know, that
he capitalized. I mean, you know, these kind of results are going to help bring that entry into that leader circle group, you know, finishing 14 when other, you know, cars that are in the 10th to 20th rank, you know, had issues and didn't even finish. So I think, yeah, it's a great start from him. Kept it clean, you know, and, you know, ran well all weekend. So yeah, good job.
Other driver that I felt like kind of kept it clean, climbed from the back of the field, Pietro. I mean, I don't know a ton of, honestly, about his weekend, but Pietro Fittipaldi qualifying 26th, finishing 15th. That's a really strong start. We didn't get to see what Christian Lundgaard, the team's kind of perceived top driver, was able to do this weekend. Lap one, he gets clipped from behind, I think actually maybe from Alex Palou. He has a right rear puncture, has to go into the pits. And so he's kind of hoping for a super wacky race in terms of yellows. And we didn't have that too much.
He led eight laps. I kind of thought he was at the beginning of the race when that happened. And then we got that first yellow. I really thought he was going to be sitting pretty, and it just didn't happen the rest of the race for him. You know, the rest of the yellows that occurred just fell in a position where it didn't allow him to capitalize on that off strategy. So
I guess I'm sometimes not the best on some strategy stuff. Would he have probably need this to turn into a three-stop race instead of a two-stop race to be able to make that work? Does that make sense? Or what do you feel like he would have needed there?
I just, the timing of the yellows, I just think just, you know, really, you know, helped guys make their pit stops under yellow than they needed, and it didn't allow him to sort of capitalize on that early stop, and he sort of bought himself some extra fuel. So I think it did need to stretch out and you know, turn into a free stopper for him to you know, reap the rewards and be able to run flat out the entire time and make use of that extra fuel that he took on. But you know, yeah, so it's kind of odd. And honestly, it kind of, being on the couch here on the TV, you know, watching it on TV, I lost track of what happened to him, to be honest, because it just, we never focused on anyone other than the top five, to be honest. So
yeah, I mean, you had some thoughts there kind of watching the race broadcast from home. Take us through a little bit of what that experience was like. I know it's sometimes even different whether you're watching it on NBC versus watching it on Peacock. Sometimes there's side by side during commercial breaks. Sometimes you got full screen commercials, which are always very frustrating for fans, especially as we've seen F1 broadcasts on ESPN through Sky Sports be able to go commercial free the last couple of years. That, you know, commercials and races is not a new thing for IndyCar, but it's definitely a very different experience than those F1 broadcasts. Take us through what week one 2024 season on NBC and Peacock was like.
Yeah, I got some thoughts. You know, it's you. I started the weekend off watching, you know, practice and watching the F1 race, and you get to see how they run a race and see the good parts and the bad parts. And, you know, I think that IndyCar, you know, there's an opportunity here to reap the rewards of what F1 is doing with Drive to Survive. Drive to Survive has turned a lot of new eyeballs onto motorsport in general. So I try to watch the broadcast from the eyes of maybe someone that's never been exposed to a sport, IndyCar, maybe he's channel surfing on Sunday, flicks on, sees a race car. He's just finished watching season three or whatever they are on Drive to Survive. And it's an opportunity to capture that that audience member and get him engaged in the sport. And I just felt like NBC was just trying to do too much. You know, there's the saying less is more, and I felt like the start of the first 40 laps of the race, we kept bouncing around from like segment to segment, and it just really distracted from what was going on, made it really hard to follow what was happening in the race. We've got 27 cars out there all battling for position. You know, there should be something exciting that we can bring up, you know, whether it's a replay of a pass or, you know, a moment that, you know, the leader has or something going on, even strategy in the pits. You know, I kind of lost track of what happened to Lundgaard. He was leading on this off strategy, and then all of a sudden he's 23rd, 24th. And I'm like, I don't really know what happened there. So, you know, I just feel like they try to cram too many segments into the broadcast. You know, at one point we spent one, maybe two laps talking about Rinus VK's wife, which is great. Maybe that's a practice session topic, you know, maybe not during a live broadcast on NBC when we got this opportunity to capture these fans. You know, and I'm someone that's invested in the series. Like, I'm engaged, wanting to watch, and I'm sitting there wanting to watch the race. I come to watch a motor race, and, you know, when you got this Mickey Mouse stuff going on, I just felt myself disengage and almost felt the urge to be like, I wonder what's on Netflix, you know? So, like, they've got to realize that, like, when you disengage from live action, it creates this opportunity for the casual viewer to tune out and continue channel surfing. You know, we've got to hook these guys. We've got to stay engaged on the live action. And the only example I can give of that is you wouldn't ever find in a football game, they're on second down and four, and all of a sudden we cut away to do a feature on Anthony Richardson's wife, who's a baker. I don't know. You know, I'm just using that as an example. Mm-hmm. And then we come back and it's first and 10, and you're just like, what happened? You know, I'm not saying that they were putting those segments in these crucial moments, but it doesn't matter. There's 27 guys out there, you know, being on a pit stand myself several times, being in the race myself several times, we're all fighting tooth and nail. So there has to be something interesting going on that can keep the viewer engaged in the race and what is happening right now. You know, so that would just be my thoughts there. And maybe I'm wrong, I don't know, but it's just my opinion, just watching it just feels like less would be more. You know, just focus on the race. Don't disengage us with features. Do the features in practice sessions, do the features before the race even starts. Keep us on the live action, and we've got more chance of keeping these viewers engaged and keeping them tuned in. The other thought as well, and I know I'm the only one, and I know it's easy to say, but, you know, too many ads, you know, NBC, it's a business. They have to utilize commercial ads to be able to pay for the broadcast rights. I get that. But it's a kind of a chicken and egg scenario. When you have too many ads, again, these breaks in the live action, viewers tune out. So it's a vicious cycle. You get less viewers, you need more ads, you know, to make up the revenue. So it's sort of like it's a negotiation that the series really needs to think about moving forward, is how do we have less ads during live action? And, you know, how do we... that needs to be something that they discuss moving forward you know, as they go into negotiations with the TV rights. I mean, you know, again, I know it's easy to say there's too many ads because they're trying to run a business, but, you know, we're trying to build a fan base back up. And when we get these guys' eyeballs on the sport, we need to keep them there. And again, the ad breaks, they're really long, with these three or four laps. And it's just so easy for people to tune out that are not invested.
Yeah, there's oftentimes a discrepancy on how this works between NBC broadcast and Peacock. And I don't think I even know where this is more prevalent, but, like, I know the times when you can do a side-by-side where you've got the on-track action still on TV and it's just silent. You've got an ad playing next to it, kind of like the look of our podcast right now, for those of you who are watching here on YouTube. I think that's so key, and it's so important, because you're still, you know, you're getting the ad fed to you, but you're still at least able to see what's going on. You know, they've still got camera crews that are following the on-track action, just like they would be if the booth of Lee Diffie and Townsend Bell and James Hinchcliffe were on the broadcast talking. And so if there's a big moment, they will catch it and you can see it. And when they, you know, come back from the commercials, you'll be able to see it. I know you can't do that all the time, because I'm sure for those commercials, you know, you're bringing in less money because it's not full screen. It's a smaller picture, and you've got someone who's maybe a little bit more distracted. They're not entirely watching it because there is some racing action on the TV. I wonder if You know, I don't watch too many NASCAR broadcasts, but I do know that it does seem like there are a lot of, you know, this restart is sponsored by, you know, insert company here, or they've got ways where they can put a logo on the TV screen, like at the bottom of the running order that's typically on the left side of your TV. You know, I wonder if there are more ways you can do something like that on the broadcast in general. I imagine this is probably even more so a struggle for the first race of the year, where you're hoping you've built up some sort of an audience this off season. Oftentimes this is one of the larger TV audiences that you have for the first couple of races until we get to the 500, because there's so much, you know, pent up excitement about seeing what the first race of the year is like. You know, I wonder what that battle for some of those guys is between trying to entertain your casual fan that doesn't know as much about IndyCar and bringing something for the hardcore fan. And it did certainly feel like maybe this pivoted a little bit too much in that in one direction. I do wonder if you could do some of these fun segments about, you know, like what the car feels like when, you know, without power steering, that they had, you know, they had that segment in there that felt like we lost a couple laps just talking about that. And feel like something that you could totally address in practice. And I know, I guess practice is probably where a bunch of your hardcore fans are watching. So maybe they already know that. So yeah. I don't know how you,
but the segments on Drivers' Lives, like, yeah, you know, Renus's wife, we showed a couple of guys getting married. Those are segments that you could definitely move to the practice sessions. Mm-hmm. The hardcore fan that's bought in, already invested in the series, that's tuning into the practice sessions, they're the ones that are going to find that color commentary, you know, insightful and interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, but during the NBC race, you know, when the casual fan that's just tuned in doesn't even know who Rena's VK is at the minute,
sure,
we don't need to be maybe showing Renus's wife boxing for two laps. It's just my opinion. And there's nothing against Renus or his wife. Love them, but just maybe not during, you know, green flag laps. We shouldn't be focusing on that. You know, we should be focusing on the battle. The other thing I'll say, and I'll leave it at that, but is that I feel like the graphics in general, it's kind of stagnant. You know, the graphics, the technology, when you're watching the Formula One broadcast, I know they've got a lot more invested money in the series, but they're really utilizing technology to give more insight in what the drivers are going through, what the strategies, how the strategy is developing. I really like it when they're showing, you know, a battle on track, and they can show the two guys previous four laps, and they can show how that expected battle is going to, you know, take place. That's something that I think IndyCar could invest in, bring that graphic up, and that would give them talking points for the presenters to be able to talk about those specific points that keeps us engaged in the actual race that's going on. Something else they could look at is some biometrics. You know, I think there's definitely ways that we can use technology to instead of Marty Snyder on pit lane holding a couple of dumbbells, moving them around, throwing them around. Like, instead of that, we could easily implement heart rate monitors on all the drivers, that we can bring up their biometrics. Look how Pato O'Ward, you know, looking at this segment right here as he leaves the pits and he's hustling, his heart rate's up to 180, you know, like, mm-hmm. there's a way to bring technology into this, bring new sensors, new data that I think would really benefit the way that we consume the race. And I think that, you know, that's just something where it's got a little stagnant on that front. And even the graphics look a bit dated. It's just like, overall, there's just things that I would like to see them. How do we make this product better? How do we make it easier for the fans to consume? Mm-hmm. And that's all I'm really getting at there.
I think one thing too that F1 broadcasts do really well, and it's almost kind of because the races are so unexciting at the front, is you see a lot of, like, let's switch over to this really awesome battle for like mm-hmm. sixth place. And you kind of have to do that because Max is 20 seconds ahead
exactly.
and running away. And if you just focused on him, or even sometimes if you focus on the top three or four in the race, those aren't all that exciting. And one of IndyCar's best characteristics is the fact that those fights in the front three or four or five cars are so great. But I do wish we did a little bit more. I mean, they run through the field, but yeah. I mean, when you can tell that Sunday's race is turning so much into being a fuel saving race, and you're probably not going to have a whole lot of, you know, once we get 10 laps and past a restart, you're not going to have a whole lot of jockeying between Colton Herta and Scott McLaughlin and Pato O'Ward and Will Power for second, third, fourth, and fifth. And so I would have loved to have gotten a little bit more of a sense what was happening back, you know, in 6th through 10th or 6th through 12th, because I do think there was some interesting stuff going on there, and we didn't maybe get
1,000,000%.
I didn't get to see as much of that. And it's maybe not as much part of the thought process, I think, even sometimes, because the racing at the front is so good, and that's something yeah. we love about the sport. But I would love to see if there are ways to do that. Sometimes it's you get some of that, and then all of a sudden there's a pass that's, you know, they oftentimes you know, are like running through the field. Oftentimes it's the pit reporters that are kind of going back and forth, like, this is what has happened to, you know, Alex Palou is currently sixth, and now let's go over to Kevin Lee, who's going to talk about the guy who's in seventh, and you kind of like alternate and go through the field that way. And sometimes they get through 20th, and sometimes they get cut off at ninth because there's something crazy going on, and that's all we get through the field. So I know they do that some, but would love to see that a little bit more if there are ways to incorporate that.
I felt like the last 10 laps of the broadcast, they really just focused in on the few battles that were happening on track, the top 10. They showed a lot of on board footage, and the last 10 laps was really engaging. So it's like, how do they take that and do that for the entire 100 laps? And I think, as I go back to, less is more, cut away some of the segments that distract and just focus on the live action that's going on, and try and emulate that 10 laps and do it the whole 100 laps, and they'd be golden. Because mm-hmm. like you said, the on-track product, I mean, I watched the F1 race. The presentation was incredible. Obviously, they have a lot of money invested in the series. It allows them to do that. But then, absolute snooze fest. You know, mm-hmm. like, just totally dull. You know, the only exciting bit was watching the rookie Ollie Bearman, 18 years old, making his F1 debut for Ferrari. Just insane. Mm-hmm. So that was cool. But just, you know, the class of race, or the racing action in IndyCar, is just light years better than the F1 product.
Definitely is. Touch on a little bit real quick before we get looking ahead to thermal. Obviously, this was a wacky, sometimes chaotic weekend to follow off track. I was telling people all weekend, the first lap of legitimate cars going around the St. Pete track that I really solely focused in on was lap one of the race, because there was so much going on off track that I was having to do interviews for, you know, run back to my laptop. I was always in the media center when on track stuff was going on, but I was head down at my laptop, focusing, transcribing, writing stories. For those of you that maybe don't exactly know what I'm talking about, so a group of reporters, me included, had sit downs, as we typically do, to kick off the year midday before practice one on Friday with Michael Andretti and Chip Ganassi. Those two typically like to hold, just, you know, kind of catch up some of the key core reporters who are following the sport week to week or going to most of the races, and gives us a chance to catch up with them. You know, it's been a 6-month off season. Oftentimes haven't spoken to them too much. Both of them had some significant changes to their team. Michael going from 4 cars to 3, Chip going from 4 to 5. Both of them have a lot going on, even outside of IndyCar. And so it's always a great time to catch up and kind of pick their brains on where the sport is at the moment. And Michael had some very passionate thoughts about where the sport is right now, as I think is the case for a lot of team owners, honestly, probably most, to be honest. I've spoken with most of them about kind of the, with some disappointments between Texas falling off the schedule, the hybrid getting delayed for the third or fourth time, the finale that was pitched to teams and therefore teams pitched to their sponsors as this amazing spectacle, you know, badass weekend of partying and watching the race in honky tonks and on rooftops. And you had all these teams pay for these hotel rooms and these event entertaining spaces and these hospitality units, like actually in physical bars and restaurants for Sunday's season finale. And now it moves to Lebanon, Tennessee, Nashville Super Speedway, 40 minutes away. On a good day without traffic, it'll be way worse than that when we get to that weekend in September. And so they were, we come into this meeting, there had been some friction about what charter systems might look like when this sport eventually gets there. And I do think they will get there at some point. And Michael, it was actually a question that I asked. Michael was asked his thoughts on IndyCar and Penske Entertainment's original proposal around charters that came late last year, which was asking for teams to spend $1 million to buy into the system that would potentially, depending on the version, get them a guaranteed spot in the 500 and guarantee them the same type of cut of revenue in terms of, you know, annual winnings, the, you know, the purses, I guess you would call it, for races outside the 500 as they are already getting, and then have the opportunity to sell that if they chose to slim down their race teams or get out of the sport altogether. And there are a lot of team owners, including Michael, that were taken aback by the idea that they would actually have to buy into something like this when NASCAR launched it in 2016 and essentially just gave these team owners this rights free of charge. And it's something that has really worked in NASCAR for the most part, although they are in stiff negotiations for the continuance of this program beyond the 2024 season. So that has changed a lot since then. But Michael was frustrated and took that as Penske Entertainment essentially trying to get the team owners to pay for, put forth money that Penske Entertainment was then going to invest back into the betterment of the sport. And Michael essentially said, why are you taking that money from us? Why can't you put forth $20 million yourself? And eventually got to the point of saying, you know, Roger, meaning Roger Penske, if you don't have the money to do this and put forth capital, essentially do the spend money to make money model to improve this long term, then you should sell the series. And a lot of us were really surprised Michael said that. I think, at least said that publicly. I think if he had the opportunity, he might have used some different words. Hindsight is always 20/20. But that kind of set off this crazy 24 hours where you had team owners commenting on that publicly and privately. It enraged members of Penske Entertainment's executive team. They eventually brought a group together, a committee, I guess you would say, that will focus on growth opportunities for the sport moving forward. Those three owners being Jim Meyer, Zach Brown, and Dan Tauris of Andretti Global, Michael's co-owner in that team. I don't know that there's a lot more to be said on it other than some tough words were said. And I think in the grand scheme of things, we're in a better spot moving forward. Sometimes that's kind of what has to happen. Things sometimes have to be said publicly to put some pressure. And not to say that Penske Entertainment wasn't still doing things behind the scenes. They have been. They've been doing a lot. There have been silently a lot of great growth metrics that have come from the sport these last couple of years. But sometimes things have to be said that create some tension for a little while in order to get things moving in the right direction long term. And I do think we are there. I'll have some more to write and say about that here in the next couple of days as I catch up on some more stories to write. But that's kind of my takeaway on where things were. Quick before out of that, I know there was one thing you were wanting to touch on, Stefan, more from the technical side. Michael had an idea about how to approach IndyCar's next set of technical regulations, that being adopting IMSA's engine formula for its GTP class. something very intriguing, and I'd love to kind of get your take on what you feel like that would mean from a technical side, from a manufacturer side, if we went that route.
Yeah, I read your article that you logged on this, you know, some of Michael's comments. I won't say too much more. I mean, there's definitely friction there inside the series. You know, the team owners want what's best for themselves. They maybe don't see all of the obstacles and the challenges that Rogers faced himself. You know, at the end of the day, Rogers invested in the series his own money. You know, and this is more of just, you know, I wouldn't say a passion project, but he's definitely not making money off the series right now. It's his own money he's investing. Not. So we got to take that into account. And the definitely the, you know, surviving COVID, you've got to take that into account as well. He bought it at like the worst possible moment. Mm-hmm. So I won't say anything more there. The some of the comments that came out of that though, Michael had a thought about, okay, instead of casting this net so small for the engine manufacturers, you know, because we're really in a situation now where we need a third manufacturer to reduce the costs on the two that are already invested in the series. That has to happen. That really is an important part of the future growth of the series, I believe, is to add an engine manufacturer here. You know, but instead of casting the net so small, why don't we take the regs that have already been developed by IMSA and GTP? It's already been super successful. I think there's five manufacturers.
Yeah.
I don't, to be fair, I should be a little bit more clued up, but I'm not even sure how the hypercar rules from Europe, you know, how close they're related. I think they're pretty close. Mm-hmm. To the GTP rules. So, you know, technically there's Ferrari there, which Chrysler, you know, easily could adopt. And, you know, you've got some really amazing brands like Porsche.
Yeah, I mean, I'll list off the ones in IMSA right now. I mean, you got Lamborghini, you've got Porsche, you've got BMW, and Cadillac. There's your five. I mean, that's a great group of manufacturers.
If you could get five, you know, so instead of casting that net so small and just being like, we just need to add one manufacturer. At the end of the day, like any regs that they come up with, these manufacturers go and have to go and spend 10, 20, 30 million to develop that product to go and fit into these regulations. So it's a big ask, you know, and that's not total. That's just year one, just to develop this and then to put the people in place to run these engines. So if you can take a rule package that's already there and maybe it needs some adapting. I don't know how feasible it all is because the IMSA engine or the GTP engine is about 100 pounds heavier than the IndyCar engine. So there's, you know, there's going to have to be some compromises there, some adaption to this. But if you can make it so that barrier of entry, you know, for these manufacturers to go and spend another 20, 30 million developing another package, another product to go and, you know, fit into an IndyCar. If you can make it so it actually helps them because then they're able to justify the spend even more. Well, we've developed this engine that fits in the GTP car and it also fits in the IndyCar. So we're getting double return by developing this one engine package. So if you could do that and attract, you know, not just one more engine manufacturer, but three or four. And these are big brands, Porsche, and you just named them, BMW. They all have a marketing budget as well. And if they're marketing their involvement in the series, it just helps the series grow and the sport grow. So I think that's something that really needs to be looked at. You know,
you've got some connections already. You've got Rahal's running BMW and IMSA. You've got you know, Rogers running Porsche in WEC and in IMSA. Like you've got some connections there that are already pretty strong.
So yeah, again, I don't know how feasible it is. It's probably going to take an engineer. I'm pretty engineer minded, but I don't know all the ins and outs of the GTP engine and how that could, you know, how an IndyCar could accommodate it. I also think just from a cool factor, you know, having IndyCars with different, completely different engines. I mean, in GTP right now, there's V8s, normally aspirated, racing against, you know, V6 turbos, and just the rule package is kind of open, but also quite closed. I mean, there's no, you know, you're going to have to do some BOP probably, but just that storyline of a V8 going up against a V6 and, you know, the differences there in technical, in the technicals, is going to be something that really interests and engage, you know, part of the fan base. So, you know, I thought that was an interesting comment. I had this thought myself, you know, like how cool would that be? I didn't think it was feasible, but when I heard Michael talking about it, I'm like, maybe it's more feasible than I thought. So that gives me some excitement. I think it's something that needs to be really looked at, and how that could work. Obviously, it would require a new car, but I think we're getting to the end of the DW12, the IR18. Actually, what's the latest?
I don't even
IR23. I don't know.
They added the aero screen. Yeah. So theoretically, this is not the IR18 anymore. But I that's kind of the same thing.
Whatever it is, I mean, yeah. This car has had a very good tenure. We've seen aero kits. We've seen the aero screen. We've seen different body kits. I just think this car needs to come to an end. We need a new chassis because what keeps happening is every year the teams have to keep investing to make this chassis, bring it up to date. And it, every time we do that, you know, it's not like $100 here, $20 there. We're talking hundreds of thousands, you know, potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars. And when you've got a team, yeah,
per car,
four or five cars, you know, that's $500,000 right there, potentially, that you've just invested to, and allow this car to accommodate the aero screen or accommodate the hybrid system. So it further handcuffs these teams because this car has become kind of a money pit. You're handcuffing into it. So at some point we've got to break that cycle, get a new car that allows us to accommodate all the improvements in safety that we've experienced over the last 10 years. And then also fits the these new regulations that could attract multiple manufacturers. So, there was some good bits that, you know, interesting bits that I took away from Michael's comments that I think at the end of the day, he's just wanting to see the series healthy. And I think that's what we all ultimately want. So he's got some passion there, but I can also see Roger's side of things where this has been a big, costly endeavor for him to make this series try and grow the series, and he's doing, you know, he's made some really good steps, and he's doing out of his own, all of his own money and out of his own pocket. So you've got to give him some credit there.
Real quick to wrap up the IMSA GTP formula thing there for a couple of thoughts. So Michael mentioned some, because our immediate reaction is like, why do you want to bring BOP to IndyCar? And for those of you who aren't, balance of performance. So that's the ways in which IMSA's sanctioning body kind of, you know, helps bring the field together when you have different cars that, you know, are better or worse on aerodynamics or their engines are different. He made it sound really simple. I can't imagine it's this simple when it comes down to it, but he said, you know, you put torque sensors on the engines that are all different, so you can kind of keep them in line. And then you have the same, you have a spec chassis. So you still have, whether it's Dallara or someone else, you have a spec chassis, and every engine has to fit into the engine bay for the car. So you can't have a super tiny engine that gives you this massive advantage on weight. You can't have this massive engine that's, you know, going to overpower everyone else. There are ways that you can kind of help keep things in check there a little bit. I don't know enough about it to know how much that would be. The other thing I wanted to ask you, that you, maybe you have an answer on this. So when you say the IMSA engines are 100 pounds heavier, is that 100 pounds with the addition of IndyCar's hybrid system in the mix, or is that without that? Because that's obviously going to weigh a little bit, and that's going to bring things a little bit. So I don't know when you're referencing that number. Is
again, that's just kind of I believe it's 100 pounds difference between the current engine in IMSA and GTP and the current IndyCar engine. Okay. It's about, I mean, it's just over 100 pounds. Again, I'm not an engineer. I'm going this off just what I've researched over the weekend. You know, so I'm sure there's, don't quote me on that. I could be a little off, but that's what I believe is the difference. Obviously, okay. You've got an IMSA GTP is just a much bigger car. You've got a lot more space in there compared to an Indy car. So
they have an actual battery that's powering that instead of the super capacitor that's so condensed, because that's part of the thing that I think was so tough about this IndyCar project is that no one had ever really done this before. You couldn't just take the IMSA program and bring it over here. They were developing the supercapacitor system that's so tiny and compact and could fit in the car that they already have. So I wonder how that would change.
Absolutely. If I'm not mistaken, I think the hybrid system that's going into the IndyCar, it weighs about 100 pounds, I believe.
Okay.
So if you were to take that into consideration, then weight-wise, if we can accommodate an extra 100 pounds in this car, then we could technically accommodate those engines. Size-wise, again, I'm not sure of the size comparison. These are all things that you'd need to look at. Like I said, you might have to take those regulations and maybe adapt them slightly so they'll fit in an Indy car. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely the building blocks there, the foundation at least. And at the end of the day, you're trying to make this as easy as limit that barrier of entry for these manufacturers, make it so Porsche can just take that engine and go, let's go and run the Indy 500. You know, like that's kind of stuff that we want to see as fans. Take us back to the heyday when there's multiple manufacturers all competing for the biggest prize in motorsport, in my opinion. So the other thing as well is touching on BOP, you know, right now it's free reign. Chevy and Honda, I mean, there's regulations that are in, but they've spent millions and millions of dollars each year to improve the product that's in the car. And that doesn't really do a whole lot for the casual fan. We don't see those advancements. If you have some BOP there, maybe there's a way that you can take those dollars been spent on finding a tenth of a second here or finding an extra horsepower here and make it more meaningful and put those dollars into marketing the series, mm-hmm. and increasing the viewership, increasing the eyeballs on the series. So, mm-hmm. you know, if you have Porsche into the series that, you know, and they're not spending all this money developing the engine, they can promote, hey, we're racing the Indy 500 this year for the first time in 20 years. Got to be more than that, actually 30 years.
Wow. Yeah.
You know, so that would be, you know, again, another thing that could help the series by bringing these extra manufacturers in.
Yeah. Exciting to see how that goes. Really, I think if they are going to have some new changes for 2027, and now at the moment, that's the first year that Chevy and Honda are no longer contracted with IndyCar. Their current deals run through 26. So that's why you hear things about 27 and about the potential of a new car and a new engine formula for 27. So that's why things could look very different. I do think if they are making changes for 27, those decisions are going to have to be made, and we'll have some announcements on that in the next couple months, if that's the target. I don't know how realistic that is. I know Honda obviously is considering their options and thinking about whether they're going to be an IndyCar. And I don't know that that's a decision that they're prepared to make in the next couple months necessarily. But if this is the direction we go and they feel like, you know, we're going to be an IMSA for a long time and we like that formula that we're competing with there and we're willing to bring that over. I know I think if I remember right, not the internal combustion engine part of their Acura right now, I think is the 2.4 liter twin turbo V6 that was supposed to be the IndyCar engine, that the product that got scrapped about 15 months ago when they decided that they needed to stay at 2.2 to limit costs and be able to focus on the hybrid system part of this. So they've got some of that already developed. Will be something that we'll continue to follow, and hopefully we have some more information and some more idea of what the direction is that the series will be going here in the coming months. Now to look ahead real quick before we say goodbye. So next on track IndyCar action that we have coming, I think there is a test between now and Thermal, but the big thing that we're all waiting for to see how this goes is the Thermal $1 Million Challenge. That race is March 24th. We have 2 days of testing coming up that Friday and Saturday. So that's March 22nd and 23rd at the Thermal Club. those tickets have been cut down pretty substantially. If you are interested in doing that, originally $2,000, now just $500. I believe those are still available. But to give you a sense of kind of what that weekend is like, I'm looking at it right now on my phone. Friday, cars are on track. Again, these are local times, so just those for Eastern time, Mountain time accordingly, but Pacific time. I think this will all be covered on track on Peacock, this testing, 9 to 11 on Friday and then 2 to 5 later in that afternoon. And then Saturday you have more testing, 9 to 11 and 1 to 3. And then we have qualifying for the heat races that will be run on Sunday morning, Pacific time, early afternoon. If you are watching on the East Coast or Central Time or what have you. So those qualifying runs, I believe there is a draw on Thursday that will determine what groups you are qualifying in. And then those qualifying sessions on Saturday, those are starting at 5 p.m. Pacific. So that is 8 p.m. Eastern Time. I believe that will also be shown on Peacock. Those will essentially set the field for the two heat races that we have. Those two heat races, the top six then from those on Sunday morning or early afternoon, the top six from both of those two. So that'll be groups of 13 and 14. So roughly half, a little bit less than those top six will move on to the main event that will be run Sunday. And that the winner of that event will be your $1 million challenge winner. Again, those times on Sunday, race heat number one, 9:31 green flag, so 12:30 Eastern time. And then race heat number two, 10:05 or 1:05. And then the all-star race is a 10:59 Pacific time green flag. All of this is being aired on NBC, so it should be easy for folks to find, obviously, on Peacock if that is your choice as well. Interested to see what that is all going to look like. I'll have some more on IndyStar.com breaking all of that down. Real quick before we go, Stefan, what do you think about that format? I don't know if it's something that we will see more of beyond this non-points paying race. I don't know if this is something that you really could use in an IndyCar weekend, but what do you think about what we will hope to see when we get to Saturday and Sunday next in a couple weekends?
Yeah, well, you know, first thing to note is how short the races are, you know, so there's going to be no fuel saving that we saw at St. Pete. These are going to be, you know, running hard as they can, you know, from green flag to checkered flag. So
those are 10 laps on those heat races I'm just looking at right now and 20 laps in the main event. So no, very good point.
Yeah, no tire saving, no fuel saving, just running hard. There's no points on the line. There's no championship implications on the line, which hopefully unlocks some good battles, some good aggressive racing. You know, so, you know, I'm not sure I'm a fan of this format going more than outside of this points paying race. I don't want to see something like this impact the overall championship, but from an entertainment standpoint, it should be very, very high value for the fans watching at home. It should be quick races that really capture the audience. So going back to my point earlier on the broadcast, the last 10 laps of that St. Pete race was really engaging. Let's limit the segments. Let's focus on all these 10 laps. Let's really try and you know, get some eyeballs on the sport.
I'm excited to see it. I know this kind of is a little somewhat similar maybe to what we see on Formula One sprint race weekends. Mm-hmm. It's not a direct comparison, but there's some similarities there. So I wonder if this is something where you could add it into a couple weekends a year where there's some more points on the line, there's some more on-track action. If, you know, if you're at a race where there's not as many support events, you could add something else. I know teams would probably love more practice time because practice time is so limited, especially on road and street course weekends. But I appreciate the series for taking a chance on something and trying it. There's not a whole lot to lose here. I mean, this fills a hole in the schedule that was going to be there if, you know, we'd already lost Texas. So I think this is something the series might have been working on regardless, coming off the weekend test that we had at the Thermal Club a year ago in February of 23. And this gives us something to look forward to. There will be a 4-week break between Thermal and Long Beach. So we've got 6 weeks until we have some points paying IndyCar action, but exciting idea. Like to see how it works and excited to come away from it and see if there's an idea of what we might see from this because they took this risk and try this experiment. So
100%.
There you have it. Thank you for everyone tuning in. We had a great audience for this relaunch of this podcast last week, previewing St. Pete and talking a little bit about the off season. We'll be doing this again periodically through this spring. We'll have another one in a couple weeks after the Thermal Club $1 Million Challenge, recapping that. Excited getting a chance to do this again. Again, thank you so much, Stefan, for joining me on this. This is, again, IndyCar Weekly. You can find it on your typical podcast platforms, Apple, Spotify. You can watch this on YouTube if you're so inclined. Again, that's the IndyStar YouTube channel. You can watch this on IndyStar.com. Thanks so much for watching. Feel free to chime in with some of your thoughts on if there's segments you would like us to try out, if you have some questions. This is a fun way to get to recap a weekend. I'm still very much in St. Pete mode. I've got a handful of stories that I'm working on here over the next couple days before the weekend gets here. So be sure to keep tuning in on IndyStar.com. I'll be tweeting out all those stories if you follow me on X, formerly known as Twitter. But great to be back. Thanks again, Stefan. And this is Nathan Brown for IndyStar and IndyStar's IndyCar Weekly. Thanks.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.